Hello, and welcome to Tallahassee Tree Talks. I'm Daniel Siegel. In this podcast, I'm going to be talking to citizens of Tallahassee about knowledge, experiences, and stories that have to do with one of our city's most incredible characteristics. Trees play major roles in our lives, and we also play a major role in the lives of trees. Join me as I get to know more about people, trees, and their relationships in Tallahassee. This podcast is sponsored by a community engagement grant from the Sunshine State Biodiversity Group in Tallahassee, Florida, a nonprofit aimed at conservation, education, and community outreach on environmental issues facing the region. For more information, visit sunshinestatebiodiversitygroup.com. In this episode, you're going to hear about sugar factories, how weird North Florida is, setting forests on fire, why your lawn is basically a desert, and most importantly, what you can do to help protect the trees around you. There's one name that pops up more than any other when searching for information about trees in Tallahassee.
My name is Stan Rosenthal. I'm a senior forester currently with Natural Resource Planning Services. I'm also University of Florida IFAS Forestry Extension Agent Emeritus. I retired a little over 8 years ago from University of Florida, and I still work with them quite a lot because they call me and ask me to do things like this. I've been in Tallahassee since the late 80s, but I have a career that's gone on quite a bit longer than that. I lived in Wyoming for a number of years and fought forest fires and things like that. But I really started doing urban forestry in the mid 80s when I moved to Central Florida, both on the West Coast, Bradenton, and then in the East Coast, Martin County, which is Stewart, where I lived. But I made it up here into the late 80s, and I did a variety of things. There was education, but I did a lot of urban forestry too, and I still do.
Stan's involvement with trees began a long time ago.
I grew up in Minnesota with no accent, yeah. So anyway, my parents bought some land on a lake in the northern part of the state, and I just fell in love with nature. And my mom was an artist, and I got the art of and the beauty of nature. I'm just always in awe of it. And I just realized how special that art is and how lucky we are. You know, we're still looking for an exoplanet that has all this stuff, you know? And so it's a really special place, and trees are a big part of it. And
Besides being very experienced when it comes to trees, Stan is a natural teacher. Before I even started asking questions, he was telling me about the trees that surrounded me. We met in the Florida Forestry Association building, where each room is built from a different type of wood.
Yeah, I thought, where should we meet? And I thought, oh, this is a good office. It's kind of quiet here, but it's easily accessible. And like they said, they don't even have anybody. There's one person in the building.
Yeah. And it's an upstairs.
Yeah, it's perfect. And the wood walls actually make good insulation for the sun.
Yes. Yeah, this is Pecky cypress. It's a cypress, but they call it Pecky because they get these pecks of wormholes in it.
While Stan is an expert at dealing with trees, he doesn't see trees as his primary job.
Do you want to ask me a question?
I have a long list,
yes.
I think. The first thing is just tell me about yourself and your relationship to trees and how that's formed over time.
Oh, that's a great question. So a lot of people, oh, Stan, you must have a great job. All you have to do is deal with the trees. I said, the trees do fine by themselves. It's their relationship to the humans that I have to manage. So I'm really managing people, and I'm giving them information on trees. So trees, what do they do for people in the urban setting? Well, you know, in the rural settings, you've got, I would start a class and I'd say, you know, how many people here use toilet paper? Okay. So, right. So we're all using trees for things like that and wildlife and things like that. But in the urban settings, we get shade, really important in the summer. There's beauty. We use trees to define spaces and all that sort of stuff. There's historic records based on, you know, old live oaks and things like that. They also provide habitat for wildlife. They also absorb a lot of pollutants in the air, which helps us. And of course, they help us with climate change because they're, you know, absorbing carbon. That's a good thing. Yeah, and you know they help us define spaces. Another thing that I really think trees do is they give us a sense of place. Tallahassee is really a city inside of a forest, and it's the trees that grow here are different than other places, and so they really define the place and they give it a characteristic all their own, and I think that's important.
Trees provide us a lot in Tallahassee, but if we want to reap the benefits of being surrounded by them, we also have to manage the drawbacks.
Yeah, on the negative side, trees can fall on people and houses and cars. So I do a lot of risk assessment. What you want to do is you want to get as much of the good stuff out of trees and as little of the bad stuff.
So, how do you go about striking that balance? What makes it acceptable to, say, chop down a tree or to deem it, worthy of being removed?
Right. The key term is education. So the University of Florida, like other universities, has research departments. So I've got a lot of research at my disposal. And what an extension agent does is the extension agents are trained to be able to understand the research, but also be able to talk to people and write to people and whatnot. So I spend a lot of time in education, like I'm doing right now. This is an opportunity for me to tell people about trees so they can make more informed decisions. I also help train the tree removal people, the ones that cut them down, they're called arborists. And there's a certification that the International Society of Arboriculture called ISA has. And so ISA has training for these guys so that they know more. And then they call on me, what kind of bug is this, that, and the other thing. And homeowners do, the city of Tallahassee does, the city of Leon, all the different organizations, anybody that has a tree, which is pretty much everybody in this region, can utilize my expertise or someone like me to help make more informed decisions so they're better off. More assets, less liabilities.
Good decision-making allows us to coexist with trees in a mutually beneficial way. Luckily, we have people like Stan to help us make better decisions to mitigate risk.
There's times when we talk about risk, and actually, the International Society of Arboriculture has a risk qualification, and I have that. And so we look at trees, their health, their structure, and then we look at what targets they might hit, the value of the targets, the occupancy rate of the targets, and such things like that. And then we can kind of rate trees out as far as their risk is imminent, high, medium, or low. And it's not a perfect situation, but that's kind of how that works.
Some trees carry more inherent risk than others.
And this, of course, is a sweeping generalization because it's like, who gets cancer in our population for people? There's a lot of variability there. But certain trees like bald cypress, unpruned cabbage palms or state tree, and live oaks are really low risk, usually because they're very sturdy trees. The University of Florida went in after a lot of hurricanes and analyzed what came down. And so they rate them out by species. I have that at my disposal. But then, of course, you have to look at the tree individually because there's all sorts of things that can override that.
Sure. So what sorts of, I guess, markers of danger are there when, what signs are there that this tree might be a dangerous tree?
So assuming, setting the concept of target aside, because if a tree is high risk of structural failure, falling, and it's out in the middle of the woods and nobody goes there, then there's no risk to humans anyway. If the tree is, I look at the health of the tree and the structure of the tree. And then, of course, there's a species. If you just had the such and such plumbing or cable company dig big long trench along the tree, well, that's compromised the root system. So there's human interference. Then there's pruning. Certain trees deal with the injury of pruning better than others. And if you've got a large pruning cut and decay has entered into that, then that means the tree is less structurally sound. Then there's how trees are. There's V and U-shaped joints. And now I'm showing you this because we're on radio, but if you take the letter U, that's a pretty structurally sound joint on a tree, but a V is not, because if you look at the letter V and you think of those as two trunks, if the trunks grow thicker, which trees do, they call that secondary growth, they push apart eventually. So anyway, then there's insects and diseases, there's things called root rots, and my find the fruiting bodies of Ganoderma root rot at the base of the tree, and I'll say, well, look, you know, the tree's root system is getting rotten, blah, 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 blah. So.
Trees pose some inherent risks, but our actions can also impact or decrease the risk associated with them. This is what Stan is talking about when he says he mostly manages people.
So you mentioned things like pruning and, you know, the ways that humans impact trees.
Yes.
So what would you say that relationship is like? How do we impact the trees around us just like they impact us?
Right, right. So you kind of can envision a tree as a sugar factory. They got the leaves. That's kind of the solar panels. They capture the sun's light, and then that feeds the tree. And then the bottom of the tree, the roots, holds the tree up structurally, but also takes in water and nutrients. And nutrients are like vitamins, they're not food. The tree feeds itself by manufacturing its own foods, the sugars from photosynthesis, which we eat, like maple syrup and things like that.
Humans sometimes throw a wrench into the works of this sugar factory.
So we can impact the roots, and just starting from the bottom and working up. Soil, the roots, there's what we call the soil environment. And roots carry on respiration. All living parts of the tree that aren't actively doing photosynthesis carry on respiration, and that's what we do. We take in oxygen and give off carbon dioxide. So the roots carry that on. So if you compact the roots or compact the soil, it's harder for the root to breathe. If you cut the root, of course, that makes the tree less sturdy, and it has less roots to hold, not only hold it up, but take in water and nutrients. Then as you go up the tree, we prune trees. And why do we prune trees? Well, the branch is in the way. You know, you can't see the stop sign. We want to change the view. And we can prune trees to take out poor structure and make them safer. But when you prune trees, no matter what size it is, it's an injury. And going back to what I was saying at the beginning, this sugar factory, you're taking off branches which have leaves so the tree can't produce as much sugar. So if you own a prune a tree, you can actually make it starve to death over time. So we have a need to prune trees, we just want to do it correctly. And that goes into a whole other long subject about a guy named Alex Shigo, who wrote a book back in the 80s, I believe, called The New Tree Biology. We didn't understand this, but trees don't heal, period. We get a cut, if we're healthy, we'll heal. Trees compartmentalize. So if you imagine it like a submarine, and the torpedo hits it, the water starts rushing in. That would be the pathogens, the bacteria and the fungus. What do the sailors do? They close the doors. And that's what trees do. They have doors. And some trees have better doors than others. And what they do is they wall off these things and grow around. And a large pruning cut is difficult to wall off. And so you might invite decay, which might make the tree less safe.
Managing trees in North Florida is especially complicated. This region has some unusual characteristics.
So you mentioned, you know, some trees that are sort of unique to this region in this area. So as someone who's worked in Montana and Central Florida, what makes the trees of North Florida unique?
Well, if you look at latitudes, a lot of this latitude is desert in the world. But this place is right off the Gulf of Mexico, so we get ample amounts of moisture. And if you look at, I don't have it with me, but the U.S. Geological Survey has a web page that shows tree diversity. It's color-coded in the U.S. And we are right adjacent to one of the hot spots. It's a deep, dark red. So first off is we have an unusual amount of diversity. And in that diversity, unlike some place like Wyoming, we have cabbage palms, and they're native. We have saw palmetto, an understory kind of shrub that's a palm. We've got these live oaks that, I don't know if you've seen those yet, they're big and they have this big giant spread. That's actually an adaptation for wind events. It's a sturdier tree. It's kind of put its effort that way. But I've counted 29 oaks in this county, 5 hickories, 7 pines. Most places, you know, you go to a place like Wyoming and there's like 6 trees, and you go to a place like Connecticut, and I'm not sure how many trees, but it's probably more like 30 trees that grow there. And then this place is extremely diverse. And I ended up teaching classes on that because surveyors and everybody else needs to know all these different trees, and it's really challenging.
And so Tallahassee is sort of interesting. I've found North Florida in general, where there are sort of like pockets of different types of trees. Is that a
Oh
common
yeah. Oh
feature?
yeah. Yeah. Lots of different plant and animal communities. So, there's wet areas that have both cypress in them. They're really cool looking. And then you go down to the coast, if you're willing to really get out there, there's areas I know where it's forests of cabbage palms almost exclusively. And then there's areas that, where you got these expanses of pine trees. And then there's planted pines, which are really kind of more like corn fields, but they're raising pine trees for the many uses that we get out of them.
Yeah, so beyond just the diversity and the number of types of trees, there are just a lot of trees in the city in general. We have a lot of canopy coverage.
Yep.
What do you think it is about this city that makes that the case?
Oh, well, it's again, we're inside a forest. We built a city inside a forest. And when you fly over Tallahassee, you look down, and what do you see? You see trees, except, there's a couple things like the Capitol and stuff stick up above that, but most of it looks like a forest with very, little openings here and there where you see a pool or something like that. We just got a lot of trees, and it's gorgeous. So they're a great asset to us, but there's liability concerns too, and you have to kind of manage that.
One of the places in which our extensive canopy coverage becomes the most apparent is on our canopy roads.
So these canopy roads are really historic. Basically, the concept is if you create this canopy, it's basically a shade, and you can get more comfort during the hot summers. We didn't have air-conditioned cars, so the canopy roads were just that. And of course, they're very scenic too. And I live on a canopy road, Miccosukee, and I love it. It's gorgeous.
Stan described how shade from trees provided comfort for those traveling on canopy roads, but he also explained that, like other historical improvements to road technology, canopy roads allowed for a more efficient transportation of goods. When many canopy roads were first built, cotton was one of the most economically significant goods in Florida. The growth and transportation of cotton relied on the forced labor of enslaved people, who were often tasked with driving teams of draft animals and the carts they pulled to the coast to be shipped. Canopy roads provided comfort for those traveling on them, but the shade they provided served a more sinister purpose as well, allowing enslaved peoples and the teams of animals they drove to be worked harder and longer in the oppressive Florida heat and sun.
So, I assume that managing the trees along those roads is sort of complicated because, you're accepting a lot of risk in just choosing to have trees overhanging.
Brilliant point. Yes. So they do frequent inventory of them. And I've been involved in some of that, where they go out, train people, and they analyze all the trees of a certain size. I mean, so you're not worried about a tree that's, 12 inches tall. That's not gonna, but trees of the size that could fall on something, they need to be checked from time to time, and some of them need to be removed and replaced. And I'll be honest, if a storm comes through, I might not drive down Miccosukee Road to town. I might go down to the Highway 90 just south because it's more open. So, they have their place.
And does the weight of the road and the cars on it sort of harm the trees' root systems?
Yeah, I mean, that's an area where the root systems aren't going to grow very much, if at all, because they can't carry on respiration because of the compaction. It compresses the soil, so the porosity is gone. But the trees adapt to those things, if they've been there a long time, which they have, a lot of them. So they're fine. Yeah, it's not a big worry. What happens is when you change something in the short term of a tree. So you take a tree that's been there for 80 years and you cut half its root system off and put a road in. Well, that tree can't adapt to that, and you've invited decay, and then puts you in the liability chain.
Short-term change is much worse than long-term.
Yes. Yeah, because trees adapt to a lot of the things that we do.
So, what would you say the sort of scale is for a tree? What would to a tree be short term? Because I assume something over a 3 year span of time would be pretty quick and harder
Oh,
to adapt.
yeah. Well, it depends on the tree. It depends on the size of the tree. Daniel, you may find this out if you live long enough. As you get older, you can't adjust to things as easily as when you're younger and stress. Okay, so an older tree isn't going to deal with the stress as well as a younger tree. And of course, a smaller tree is going to need to occupy less space, and that includes its root system. So, a larger tree just, more of its root system gets impacted by a road than a small tree growing 10 feet from the road.
Not only do we have a lot of types of trees, Tallahassee just has a lot of trees, period. This makes management difficult.
Yeah, so just having so many trees around, I'm sure, makes development and building a lot more complicated.
Yes, it sure does, because you have to educate the builders that just because you didn't scrape the trunk doesn't mean you haven't damaged the tree, because the root system. So where are root systems? If you take the crown spreader, or what they call the drip line, that's how far out the branches go. University of Florida did some studying, and they found out that they'll grow up to 6 times that distance. Most trees, it's 3 times that distance. And if you use the unit of a measure of a crown spread, so you go out one, it reaches the edge of the branches, that's 1 crown spread, 2 and 3. So that's how far out they are, with cumulative 2 and 3 having more roots than zone 1. And where are they in depth? Most roots are in the top foot to 18 inches. So they're not way down. Now, if you're digging a tree out by a shovel, you're going to go, God, the taproot's humongous. But compared to the rest of the roots, that's where they are. So there's soil compaction, and then there's just cutting roots. And so what happens is I'll see trees that were, quote, saved, and the trunk is still there in the top of the tree. But what happens is the roots are so damaged, and the rooting zone has been decreased by, you know, you put a house there and things like that, it can't grow back to it. So the trees then go into this long decline. Well, sometimes quick, sometimes longer. Some trees like live oaks are really tough, and they might take 15 years to die off, whereas other trees might just take a year or two. And then the homeowners settle with that. They call me, they say, what's wrong with my tree? And I said, well, how old's the house? And where's the septic tank? And where's all this? And yeah, that's what the problem is. And they're like, you can't fix that. And then they have to take the tree out.
Because it's so complicated, there are a lot of systems in place to help manage trees, or in Stan's words, manage people in Tallahassee.
If you're going to do a development, you have to identify the trees, and some trees are protected. They get points for them by the diameter. And so they have to kind of have the points come out, or they have to pay more money. And some trees are, you know, like a big live oak is going to be a lot of points.
And do you find that that system is an effective way to manage trees?
Yes, if it's enforced properly, and sometimes it's not.
So that, I guess that would fall under that managing people category that you mentioned.
Yes. You know, and there's still a lot of development in Tallahassee. I don't know if it's as great as it used to be. And then there's just homeowners, you know. I mean, you know, you have to redo your septic tank or something like that. There's all sorts of things like that that, you know, people need help with. And sometimes the damage to the tree is unavoidable. And I'm the first one to say, like, look, you know, can you do this? Could you move this here? No. You know, you're kind of sandwiched in. I'm like, why don't you take the tree out now? Because it'll be cheaper. Because you're going to, you know, that's so much damage, it's just not going to recover. And then plant another one. And the new tree will be adjusted to that new site and probably do better. So, you know, sometimes, you know, trees are renewable, and sometimes that's the best solution. Sometimes it is best to try to save a tree.
So I would assume that it's easier to make that decision to just take a tree out when it's not a really old historic live oak or something like that.
Yeah, and it has some problem already. You know, in other words, the development or whatever hasn't started. Well, you want to go through and take out the trees that or along a road. You know, they're going to do a road widening. Well, because there's certain trees are coming out because they're that. But you want to look at, well, there's this tree that's only, it's leaning towards the road, and it's going to be 20 feet out of your area. It's going to have all this root damage. And by the way, it's got this major fungus growing on its roots already, and the crown is declining. You should take it out, even if you don't do the development. So, you know, there's that kind of thing. You just want, you want to make informed, purposeful decisions. Common sense. And, you know, sometimes that's hard to get.
So, when did you first start working in Tallahassee?
July of 88.
And have you noticed our treatment of trees change over time?
Yes. We now have an army of certified arborists, and they understand these things, and that's helped a lot. Both the city and county have put ordinances that help that, but a lot of times it isn't adequately enforced. There's more of an awareness. It's got a long way to go, but it has improved. And homeowners, I think they do a better job of seeking out people that have knowledge, and it's more available. Because the certified arborists, they have to take a test and do continuing education, and that's a good thing.
Throughout Stan's career, he has often been the person called in to make informed decisions. This makes sense. He is, after all, an expert. He has more information to work with than most people. but he's also worked to inform others, allowing them to make better decisions of their own.
Teaching is an interesting thing. So first off, UF has this thing, it's actually national, it's called Master Gardener. And rather than try to teach everybody, what you do is you get people that that are interested in that to come from all their different neighborhoods, and then you have this class. And the trade-off is, we'll give you this training for next to nothing, but we want you to do so much volunteering, and then you go back into your neighborhood and help educate people. Okay, so that's one way. Then we do training for arborists, okay, and that's really helpful. And then TV, radio, podcasts, newspapers, whatever you can do, anything on the internet. You just want to keep repeating and educating. And you're not going to reach everybody, but you know, you want to reach most as many people as you can.
And have you found that people in Tallahassee are particularly receptive, or are there some groups that are, you know, give you a little more pushback?
Sometimes I get it from the development community, but not too much. Most people are pretty receptive. And I get utilized that for a lot. As long as I'm basing my decisions on sound science and things like that. Yeah, that's, you know, that's what we try to do with our health with doctors and things, you know?
Yeah, so a little bit of a tree doctor and a little bit of a yes. Lorax, I guess. You get called on whenever someone needs to speak for the trees.
Yes, yes. You know, it's funny. I remember, I think it was my wife said something about the thorax. Somebody told me one time, I was like, thorax, what's that? Well, then I had to watch it. Yeah, so tree doctor, thorax. Yeah, so I'm an advocate for good tree management and education. We don't know everything about trees. We can't predict everything about trees. We don't know what the next hurricane's going to be, if and when we get one, things like that. But we want to make the best decisions we can based on what we know.
This raises an important question. Are we making the best decisions that we can in Tallahassee?
Just my seat of the pants, pretty good, but we have a long way to go.
And what steps would you say would be the most important to take?
Well, there's invasive exotic plants. We still have people that have lots of invasive exotic plants in their yards, and it spreads to other people's yards, and it spreads outside of urban areas and causes a lot of wildlife habitat destruction. That's one of them. Just realizing that trees do have risk, and that you have a responsibility to deal with trees that have risk if they hang over your neighbors or they hang out into the street and all that sort of stuff. And then just things that we can do to manage our trees better, like not chipping up the roots with the lawnmower, but putting a mulch bed there. And then you know, trees help us with stormwater a lot. You know, in lawns, grass does a really good job of holding the soil, not a very good job of absorbing water, where mulch beds absorb way more water. And then that's what you get in a forest, is a giant mulch bed. So kind of we've tried to decrease lawns and increase mulch beds and things like that. And that's good for the whole community.
So making the city more of a forest and less of a lawn, I guess.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's places where, you know, the kids have to play soccer and all that sort of stuff. And lawns can be used as defensible space in wildfire situations, you know, if you're like in the exurbs and things like that. But big lawns take a lot of inputs. They're not good for climate change. They're not good for water retention. They're not good for wildlife habitat. They're pretty much biological deserts.
Another important thing to remember about our relationship with trees is that it's not a private one.
So how connected would you say that the urban forest in Tallahassee is to the rural forests that sort of surround it?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So invasive exotic plants don't recognize borders, and they spread. So it's not just about what's happening in your yard or even your neighbor's yard. It's what's happening out into the rural forest. So that's a problem. But it's a continuum. I don't know if that's a good answer, but yeah.
Stan's work has been an integral part of managing the trees within Tallahassee, but Tallahassee is also surrounded by forests. Stan doesn't just manage urban forestry.
And with regards to sort of forests outside of the actual urban area, do you do any work with things like Appalachian National Forest and other large forests?
The Appalachicola National Forest has its own foresters, sort of the state forests. But there is land managed by municipalities and counties like greenways and parks, and I help them with that. And I work a lot with private landowners, and private landowners own a lot of North Florida. And so I help them, you know, most of them, they want to be good stewards of the land. And so they need information. Actually, I was just, I know this is a blog, but I have it in my hand, a forest stewardship plan. I wrote this actually for one of the county parks. And it details what's out there, what soil types they have, what plants they have, and whether it's a private landowner or a municipal or a public, you want to define what your goals are, like wildlife habitat. It might be recreational, it might be hunting. We get a lot of resources from trees, from wood and paper and things like that. And I always told people, I says, trees are renewable and recyclable and biodegradable resource, unlike plastics and things like that. So these are good things. And they're like, well, we don't want to cut down trees. I'm kind of like, well, so you're going to pump this stuff out and put it in a landfill after you turn it into plastic, and that's a good thing? Okay, so trees will help us with that if you manage them correctly. Yeah, so the other thing to remember is how forests were managed in the past in rural areas aren't necessarily how they're managed now. For one is, we've entered in invasive exotic plants, but also fire.
Forests, like trees, sometimes have to be pruned to keep them healthy.
Fire used to spread over much of this land here, and the plants and animals have evolved to tolerate that. And so we get landowners then to prescribe burn, which is better than a wildfire for obvious reasons, because you pick the time to do it and all that sort of stuff, and you know you're going to stop it. And so those things are also part of the thing that landowners do and that we encourage.
So what are the benefits of a prescribed burn for a forest?
Okay, so there's trees like we'll identify forests. And non-forest plant communities, or actually plant and animal communities. And certain animals are dependent on that. So there's a tree called longleaf pine. And it tolerates frequent low-intensity fires. What I mean by that is some plants, like sand pine in the area, do infrequent high-intensity fires. About every 80 years it catches on fire, it's a crown fire, it burns everything to the ground. But they have cones that actually open up from the heat of the fire, and they reproduce that way. Longleaf pine does best if you have frequent low-intensity fires. See, I repeat that. That's part of education. You don't say it just once. So anyway, so every 2 or 3 years, a fire will creep through, and it never gets very strong. But that kind of keeps it open. And then there's an understory that's really rich in diversity of plants. And like one of the dominant ones often is called wiregrass. And a wiregrass clump, they found out, can live up to 600 years. And it flowers and then produces viable seed after spring, late spring, early summer burns. And so that's how the plant reproduces. And then there's an animal called the gopher tortoise. And it digs holes, and it likes this open places because, like, you know, you can imagine tortoises can't climb trees. They pretty much eat, graze down what's down on the ground. Well, these fires keeps it open, and it produces the plants that have evolved to grow in there, so it has a food source. Well, it makes these holes, and they found hundreds of different animals use these holes. So basically, you get this giant chain, and without fire, you would lose that.
Forestry requires thinking systematically. It's not about any individual tree, it's about the forest itself. Sometimes one tree has to go for several others to thrive.
I try to look at it as the cycle. In other words, I saw one study said 1 or 2% of the trees in this community that got hit by this Category 1 hurricane actually did damage. And I thought, well, you know what, if you take out 1 or 2% of the trees and replant them to other trees, you're probably better off. So it's okay to lose a tree here and there. What you want to do is have a quality urban forest or a quality rural forest. And sometimes open areas like a clear cut, that means I said, look, so you clear cut this. Well, this is going to be really good bluebird habitat for about 5 years before the forest grows up. So put some bluebird boxes out. And so there's things that you can do so you can, you don't have to look at a forest as just in the moment as a static thing. It's constantly changing. And we're part of that. And nature was doing that without us before. And so how can you fit into those constantly changing cycles so that you're managing something that's good? But yeah, you are impacting it sometimes.
These understandings have changed over time.
So when I first started, this is how people viewed land. I would hear this all the time. It's my land. I pay taxes on it. I should be able to do whatever I want with it. Well, they didn't get the connection. And then kind of what I'd call the 60s hippie movement came in. And they were like, I thought the best thing to do was leave it alone. Well, that didn't work with invasive exotic plants that would come in and take over the plant and animal community. And then, you know, the fires and that were excluded and all that. So really what it is active management. And I'm really a proponent of active management. I think that we've compartmentalized our communities and our, you know, fires don't sweep over the landscape like they used to until they hit a river bottom or something like that. And so we have to actively manage things, and I think we can do that for a better thing, and then we all benefit from that. So now, not it's my land, I can do whatever I want with it, or we should just leave it alone. Now it's like, what are my responsibilities for this land, both for the present and future generations, to get the greatest benefit out of it? And not just for humans, but other things too, like deer and elk and squirrels and everything else. You know, we're part of this bigger system, and I think we're still learning that.
So what's getting in the way of maintaining a balance between our needs and the needs of the environment around us?
We're getting better, but there's too many people on the planet. So we're overextending the resource. That's one of them. It's our lifestyle, how much we consume. The other thing is we want to keep the primary resources pretty inexpensive. And so that's why there's government subsidies for lots of primary resources like oil, but also for trees. There are federal programs and some state programs that help landowners replant their forests and things like that so that we can keep the cycle going. Because, you know, so you cut these trees down because everybody needs toilet paper and that provides jobs. And then people buy their toilet paper. So how do you get the trees planted back again? And one of the problems is it's such a long-term resource. If you're 80 years old, you know, what's the incentive to replant other than just your ethics? And so hopefully we've got systems in place that encourage people monetarily to do that.
So besides people and trees themselves and fire, what other things are sort of managing trees directly or indirectly?
Oh, insects and diseases. They're always there to looking for an easy meal. So if you let the trees grow too thickly and you stress them, a lot of times insects and diseases will override our intentions. And then there's, you know, we've got the impact of climate change. And that's huge. You know, we've got more disasters, and that, you know, knocks trees out. And then we've got, you know, drier periods, you know, that are more extensive, you know, and that changes things, you know, droughts for fire and things like that. And then just the stress on the trees. And then the insects and diseases do better for a while until the trees kind of get eliminated in that area, shall we say. It goes back to desert or prairie because it got too dry. And then, you know, there's always just giant shifts all over the place.
Have we been seeing any of those shifts in this area?
Oh, yeah. I've written a couple articles for the Tallahassee Democrat on dogwood trees. A lot of people, oh, there's a new disease. Well, there's not, okay? So what's going on? Because we used to have a lot more dogwoods in town. Well, the lifespan's 35 to 40 years, so those ones that planted that long ago died out because of natural lifespan, but people have been planting them and stuff. They're not having as much success. And so they're the canary in the coal mine for this area for me. We're towards their southern end of their range. I was down on campus at the University of Florida right after I retired. This is like 8 years ago, so it's a little older information. There was a woman who was a professor in University of Georgia, and she was a climatologist / meteorologist. And she said, look, she goes, the amount of precipitation we're getting is the same, but we get longer, more intense dry periods and wet periods. And then she says the temperature since, you know, like 30 years ago, I can't remember exact numbers, has gone up 1 degree Celsius, which translates to a week to week and a half longer growing season. it's too much for the dogwoods. Now, there are some spots where they're still doing better because, you know, everything's still just right, but you just don't see them as prolific as they used to be, and their survival rate is harder. And I know a lot of the nurseries and stuff are just saying, well, why don't you plant this other kind of tree instead because you'll have more success. And so that's sad. So the forest is already changing.
And which trees are the most resilient to climate change? Which ones will be impacted the last or the least?
It depends on what impacts you're talking about. So as far as wind events like hurricanes and things like that, some trees like live oaks and cabbage palms and bald cypress are more wind sturdy. But then if you get longer extended dry periods, you can get hotter, more intense fires. Trees like longleaf pine, if it's a low intensity fire, is going to be better off. And then if you talk about the climate changing where it's getting warmer, well, trees to the south of us are going to do better than the trees to the north of us. So complicated, you know?
Experts can learn to make decisions that create a good balance.
Well, it's interesting. So we're sitting here in the Florida Forestry Association office, and they try to promote that on a larger scale. One of the things they have, and I was actually teaching it for a while, called a Master Logger Program. And so what they do is, if you want to be a master logger, you have to go through this training for a day or two, and then you have to do continuing education. And so what that means is the loggers then kind of understand a lot of these things, like how not to cause erosion and, you know, invasive exotics, and how to help, you know, like gopher tortoises. You don't want to be driving over their burrows, you know, because that, you know, impacts them. And so they encourage a lot of that, so you have a better thing. And what's interesting is that the mills like their wood better if they're master loggers, so they've got an incentive to do it too.
So we have a complicated system with a lot of trees and a lot of people. Things get overwhelming fast. If you're not a tree professional, what can you do?
Oh, yes. Treat our trees with kindness. And not just our trees, the whole environment. Realize that it's death by a thousand paper cuts sometimes in urban situations. There's a lot of flora that's urban now. And so if you take that habitat out and convert it to your English garden setting, you know, with non-native plants, large expansive lawns, you've taken that out of the system, both the water cycle, a lot of the nutrient cycle. It takes a lot of inputs to manage that. You know, you have to go buy fertilizers and pesticides to keep that working. You want to go with more natural systems, which provide better habitat for wildlife, better recharge for water and air and all that sort of stuff. And it takes less inputs to make that. And the other thing is that when we come in and we buy plants that are from someplace else, we lose a sense of place. And so you want to work with the natural systems here. There's a huge tree palette, shall we say. So rather than buy a plant from China, why don't you buy one that's already growing here?
The other thing to remember is that there's nothing wrong with asking for help from someone with more experience.
Oh, yeah. And I should have mentioned this too. If you need tree pruning done, check with the extension office, master gardeners, whatnot, but also make sure you hire a certified arborist. And you can find that out on International Society of Boriculture's webpage. And because these guys are trained like the master loggers.
Stan has been speaking for the trees for a while, but he's taken a step back.
Yeah, so to get a little personal, at 57, I had 30 years in with the state. And this is just kind of an interesting thing. I remember I was given a botany lecture, and I started daydreaming while I was doing it, and I didn't miss a beat. And I said, Stan, you've been here long enough. But I still wanted to stay active, but so I went part-time for a company. Now I'm with this Natural Resource Planning Services. They're a fine company, mostly out of Central Florida, and they let me work when I want to, and I get calls all the time from people, what about my trees, what about my land, and all that. I also was working for the Florida Wildlife Federation as their forest advocate. The grant ran out, but they're trying to get some more money for me to come back. That's to work with private landowners, help them encourage this longleaf wiregrass, gopher tortoise forest that we were talking about before. I still like working, but I'm not working full time. And then I have time still to make for people like yourself that have great questions that, you know, this is helping the cause. I just believe in it. I'd like to think that I've made a difference. I'm a communitarian. I get that the world isn't all about me. But I drive a lot of enjoyment in helping us be better stewards of the world, you know. And, you know, I've got things to learn, and other people are doing things, you know, that are helping in other departments. But this is my department that I want to do.
Yeah, so speaking of sort of the role that you've played in Tallahassee, how many trees would you estimate that you've impacted?
Millions. Because you also have to remember, I've been working in rural forest. We're like, you know, they planted 726 trees per acre on 500 acres. You know, I used to have this, the University of Florida had this report we had to do every year. For some years, I remember writing, I would say, I got more than 1 million trees planted in this area.
Of course, I had to ask Stan about his favorite trees.
Favorite type of tree, and then favorite specific individual tree in Tallahassee?
That's hard for me to answer because I've lived other places too. And I see the value in all these different kinds of trees. If I just had to pick one off the cuff and I could change my mind probably in 3 seconds or less, I'd say bald cypress. It's just a gorgeous, that's the redwoods of the southeast. They can live quite a long time and get really large. I know forests where the knees are taller than you and I. These bald cypress have these knees that come off their roots. You and I couldn't reach around them.
Stan named a few favorite types of trees. His favorite specific tree was a lot harder to pick.
They're all so unique and interesting. My wife had to get used to me when we go driving and things. I'm just constantly distracted. Because I'm driving through my work, you know, there's always something to see.
Trees are all around us, and their lives are intertwined with our own. When we choose to live inside a forest, we are entering into a complex relationship with the trees that surround us. If we make sound decisions, we can maximize the benefits and minimize the drawbacks of this relationship. It's our responsibility and our privilege to make sure the relationship is mutually beneficial. Luckily, there are people like Stan around to help us make these decisions. Thank you for tuning in to Tallahassee Tree Talks. Special thanks goes to the Sunshine State Biodiversity Group, the Florida Forestry Association for providing a recording space, and of course to our guest, Stan Rosenthal.